Aneurysms are small balloon-like blowouts on the cerebral arteries that can, and often do, cause catastrophic hemorrhages in the brain. The aim of the operation is to place a minute spring-loaded metal clip across the neck of the aneurysm, just a few millimetres across, to prevent the aneurysm bursting. There is a very real danger that the surgeon, working at several inches depth in the centre of the patient's head, in a narrow space beneath the brain, will inadvertently burst the aneurysm while he dissects it free from the surrounding brain and blood vessels and tries to clip it. Aneurysms have thin, fragile walls, yet they have high-pressure arterial blood within them. Sometimes the wall is so thin that you can see the swirling dark red vortices of blood within the aneurysm, made enormous and sinister by the magnification of the operating microscope. If the surgeon ruptures the aneurysm before he can clip it, the patient will usually die, or at least suffer a catastrophic stroke, a fate that can easily be worse than death. The staff in the theatre were silent. There was none of the usual chatter and talk. Neurosurgeons sometimes describe aneurysm surgery as akin to bomb disposal work, though the bravery required is of a different kind, as it is the patient's life that is at risk and not the surgeon's. The operation I was watching was more like a blood sport than a calm and dispassionate technical exercise, with the quarry a dangerous tumour. There was the chase, the surgeon cautiously stalking his way beneath the patient's brain towards the aneurysm, trying not to disturb it to where it lay deep within the brain, and then there was the climax as he caught the aneurysm, trapped it, and obliterated it with a glittering spring-loaded titanium clip, saving the patient's life. More than that, the operation involved the brain, the mysterious substrate of all thought and feeling, of all that was important in human life, a mystery, it seemed to me, as great as the stars at night and the universe around us. The operation was elegant, delicate, dangerous, and full of profound meaning. What could be finer, I thought, than to be a neurosurgeon? I had the strange feeling that this was what I had wanted to do all my life, even though it was only now that I had realized it. It was love at first sight. The operation went well. The aneurysm was successfully clipped without causing a catastrophic stroke or hemorrhage, and the atmosphere in the operating theatre was suddenly happy and relaxed. I went home that night and announced to my wife that I was going to be a brain surgeon. She looked a little surprised, given that I had been so undecided about what sort of doctor I should be, but she seemed to think the idea made sense. Neither of us could have known then that my obsession with neurosurgery and the long working hours and the self-importance it produced in me would lead to the end of our marriage 25 years later. 30 years... and several hundred aneurysm operations later, remarried and only a few years away from retirement, I cycled into work on a Monday morning with an aneurysm to clip. A heat wave had just ended, and heavy grey rain clouds hung over South London. It had poured with rain during the night. There was little traffic. Almost everybody seemed to be away on holiday. The gutters at the entrance of the hospital were flooded so that the passing red buses sent cascades of water over the pavement, and the small number of staff walking to work had to jump to one side as the buses swept past. I rarely clip aneurysms now. All the skills that I slowly and painfully acquired to become an aneurysm surgeon have been rendered obsolete by technological change. Instead of open surgery, a catheter and wire is passed through a needle in the patient's groin into the femoral artery and fed upwards into the aneurysm by a radiology doctor, not a neurosurgeon, and the aneurysm is blocked off from the inside rather than clipped off from the outside. It is, without doubt, a much less unpleasant experience for patients than being subjected to an operation. Although neurosurgery is no longer what it once was, the neurosurgeon's loss has been the patient's gain. Most of my work is now concerned with tumours of the brain, tumours with names like glioma or meningioma or neurinoma, the suffix "oma" coming from the ancient Greek word for tumour, and the first part of the word being the name of the type of cell from which the tumour is thought to have grown. Occasionally, an aneurysm cannot be coiled, so every so often I find myself going to work in the morning in that state of controlled anxiety and excitement that I knew so well in the past. The morning always starts with a meeting, a practice I began 20 years ago. I had been inspired by the TV police soap Hill Street Blues, where every morning the charismatic station police sergeant would deliver pithy homilies and instructions to his officers before they set off in their police cars with their sirens wailing. It was at the time when the government was starting to reduce the long working hours of junior hospital doctors. The doctors were tired and overworked, it was said, and patients' lives were being put at risk. The junior doctors, however, rather than becoming ever more safe and efficient now that they slept longer at night, had instead become increasingly disgruntled and unreliable. It seemed to me that this had happened because they were now working in shifts and had lost the sense of importance and belonging that came with working the long hours of the past. I hoped that by meeting every morning to discuss the latest admissions, to train the juniors with constant teaching, as well as to plan the patient's treatment, we might manage to recreate some of the lost regimental spirit. The meetings are very popular. They are not like the dull and humourless hospital management meetings where there is talk of keeping in the loop about the latest targets or of feeling comfortable about the new care pathways. Our neurosurgical morning meeting is a different sort of affair. Every day, at 8 o'clock sharp, in the dark and windowless X-ray viewing room, we shout and argue and laugh while looking at the brain scans of our poor patients and crack black jokes at their expense. We sit in a semicircle, a small group of a dozen or so consultants and junior doctors, looking as though we were on the deck of the Starship Enterprise. Facing us is a battery of computer monitors and a white wall onto which brain scans are projected, many times larger than life-size, in black and white. The scans are of patients admitted as emergencies over the preceding 24 hours. Many of the patients will have suffered fatal hemorrhages or severe head injuries or have newly diagnosed brain tumours. We sit there, alive and well and happy in our work, and with sardonic amusement and Olympian detachment, we examine these abstract images of human suffering and disaster, hoping to find interesting cases on which to operate. The junior doctors present the cases, giving us the history, as it is called, the stories of sudden catastrophe or of terrible tragedy that are repeated each day, year in, year out, as though human suffering would never end. I sat down in my usual place at the back, in the corner. The SHOs are in the front row, and the surgical trainees, the specialist registrars, sit in the row behind them. I asked which of the junior doctors had been on call for the emergency admissions. "A locum," one of the registrars replied, "and he's buggered off." There were 5 doctors holding the on-call bleep over 24 hours on Friday, one of my colleagues said. 5 doctors handing over emergency referrals to each other every 4.2 hours. It's utter chaos. "Is there anything to present?" I asked. One of the juniors got up from his chair and walked to the computer keyboard on the desk at the front of the room. A 32-year-old woman, he said tersely, for surgery today. Had some headaches and had a brain scan. As he talked, a brain scan flashed up on the wall.